This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. When I say that, I mean people who are willing to put their lives on the line for our freedom. And we certainly are educated, we're entertained, we're inspired each week by these stories from our greatest generation. I know it's going to be no different today with 91-year-old Leon Christensen of Clovis, California. Grew up a little ways away from there in the small farm town of Easton. And you grew up with three brothers and two sisters. That's Danish heritage. How many generations had your family been here?
Three, I guess. My grandfather came first, and then all his kids. And then my dad came over when he was 20 years old, joined the Army, very patriotic man. And his brothers followed him, and pretty soon we had a lot of Christensens here.
I guess so. And a lot of those Danish immigrants were dairy folks. The Danish creamery was a big business around here. Did you ever have to milk any cows growing up?
Oh, boy. I lived on a farm big part of my life, and that was one of my jobs, milking the cow.
What do you remember about your childhood as far as what kind of ambitions or dreams that you had?
Well, my dad was a violin player, and he taught me to love music. And so I thought someday I would probably be a virtuoso violin player. Didn't happen, but I did enjoy my music.
Didn't happen yet. You're still working on it, aren't you?
You're still working on it, yeah.
How old were you when you started with the violin?
I was in grammar school, so probably in about the sixth grade.
And you, now all these years later, you've actually made violins?
I've made two violins,
That's got to be a painstaking process.
It is. You have to have a lot of patience. The violin I have here now, I made in 1953, so that's, 60 years old?
Yeah, and, you know, everyone's hearing you talk about the violin. I know they want to hear you play the violin, so before we're done, I'm going to have to get you to at least humor us a little bit. But music's been good to you. Maybe some of our listeners in the Fresno area have heard you play that violin in people's church over the years, and music's what introduced you to your wife, so I know it was pretty good to you. And it's a big part of your military story, too, but you would have never had a chance to make those violins if you didn't survive World War II, and in particular, June 6th of 1944, which we're going to talk about. But let me ask you first about a different date that everyone seems to remember, December 7th, 1941. You're in your senior year at Clovis High School.
Yes.
How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked?
We were on our way home from church. Dad had the radio on. So I was in the automobile going home from church when I heard we'd been attacked at Pearl Harbor.
What did that mean to you? Could you even grasp what that meant?
Well, I just couldn't imagine a little country like Japan would attack a country like ours.
And when did it hit you that this might be something you were going to have to become involved with?
I forget when they started the draft, but I had to go down and register for the draft. And I went ahead and graduated, and I was 18, and the following October, my number got real close, and I wanted to choose the service I would go in. And so, and with my dad's encouragement, we selected the Navy, and I joined the Navy.
And did your dad tell you to try the Navy because he knew what the Army was like?
Yes.
Do you remember what he told you? Was there something he didn't want you to see?
Well, my dad never went into action. He never left the country, actually. But he knew what the Army was like, and he says, you don't want to be in those foxholes. He says, in the Navy, if you could join the Navy, well, you get a shower every day and a meal every day, and which is true. So that's how we decided to choose the Navy. And I was going to do that anyway, but my dad's encouragement was wonderful.
Little did you know what you would end up experiencing, but it sounds like at least the first part of your time in the Navy was quite the adventure for you. You had some nice duty stations and some fun things to do.
I did. While I was in boot camp, they asked all of us if we wanted to apply for school in some field, you know, engineering or whatever. And I said I would like to go to the Fleet School of Music because that was really the only thing I was any good at, if you call it good. I was accepted to the Fleet School of Music in San Diego. I went there for 8 months, and they trained me and made me a better musician. And also, they trained me in the medical field where I could assist doctors and corpsmen in their duties taking care of people that needed help. Being a musician was what I was. I was a petty officer, had the little lyre on my badge and everything. I was very happy to be able to go to the school and get this training. And then, of course, that came to an end and I got assigned.
Did you ever have the opportunity to perform for VIPs or dignitaries?
No, but I marched in lots of parades.
I bet you did. But you don't see too many violin players marching in the band.
No. In fact, I got my appointment to music school through my violin playing. My trumpet playing wasn't that great. I played high school trumpet and played in the band in high school. But when I auditioned for that, they weren't that impressed. They said, do you have any other music background? I said, my instrument is really the violin. That's what I've been trained on. And he says, do you have your violin here? And I said, no, but I can get it. My dad sent it to me, and I auditioned on the violin. They accepted me.
Uh-huh.
They said they could teach me to play the trumpet better.
But they knew you had musical acumen.
Yeah.
Have you ever wondered how things would have been different if you didn't have that second chance with the violin?
I had no idea what would have happened. I probably would have been assigned to a ship somewhere.
But you did go through the Fleet School of Music, and then they sent you to a nice tropical destination.
Right. I got assigned to Balboa, which is the American settlement on the Panama Canal. And it had a nice band down there, which I joined. It was a paradise because all we had to do was have a rehearsal every morning. We played one concert a week. And then one of the trumpet players would play taps or reveille for the bass over the loudspeaker. And basically, that's all I had to do. And they had a beautiful golf course there and beautiful tennis courts. And I was both a golfer and tennis player. Tennis is really my sport. So I had a really nice year, like belonging to a country club almost. It all came to an end after a year.
During that time, and obviously you got a lot out of it. It was a great place to be. You got to play music. You got to play golf and tennis. Did you find some satisfaction in your opportunities to entertain other troops, that you were using your talents to do something for them?
I enjoyed that very much.
They probably enjoyed it too.
Well, I hope so.
Did you guys have a lot of dances and stuff play for?
The band had a dance band within the band, and I was in that.
You also mentioned guys playing taps and reveille. Is that something that you had to be part of?
Uh-huh. Maybe once a week I would have to do it.
Did you play it on a trumpet or a bugle?
On a trumpet.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll come back to that later once you get on your ship. How was it that you found out you're going to be assigned to this historic World War I era battleship, the USS Texas?
Yeah. Well, I got my orders to report for duty on the battleship Texas. And I got a 30-day leave, so I went home and had my 30 days, and I caught my ship in New York. So I had to go back on a cattle train. The trains were terrible. They used for servicemen. They were awful. I'll never forget when I walked on that ship, how big that thing was, you know, and all those big guns on there. It was really an experience.
If you can remember, what do you think your mindset was preparing to become part of this big ship that obviously is built for a purpose and that you're going to be part of this purpose?
Well, I knew that we were going to go to war, for one thing, but they don't tell us in advance. Our ship took off from New York for England, and I was one of those poor souls that got seasick.
Uh-oh.
And I got real sick, but I only lasted for a couple of days, and I was okay. Before we went to England, we went across the Atlantic and down through the Straits of Gibraltar into the Mediterranean Sea, and we were there for the end of the war in North Africa. I got to go ashore in Italy there, but we didn't really have to do hardly anything there because it was almost over that we were there for in case we were needed. Then we came back through the Straits and went up to England, and we went on the west side of the British Isles. We did a lot of maneuvering and training, and we knew through rumors that something big was going to happen and that we were going to be part of it, but we didn't know much. They didn't tell us much.
Well, there was somebody whose job it was to tell people stuff as well that ended up on your ship. Were you on the Texas when this young guy named Walter Cronkite came aboard?
Yes, but I didn't get to meet him or anything. Eisenhower came on our ship to tell us what we were going to do and before we took off for Normandy.
Yeah, I've seen some photos of that, of Eisenhower on the Texas addressing all the sailors. What do you remember about that? That, to me, seems like it was probably a little bit of a goosebump moment or an adrenaline builder.
Yes, it was, I guess. Of course, here I'm just a kid.
Yeah.
19 years old probably then. And I wasn't too serious about anything. I thought it was wonderful. I got to see Eisenhower. I'd heard so much about him as a general. But I remember one thing he said about this invasion, that if our ship was hit and would not be able to maneuver anymore, we were going to beach it. And that scared the pants off of me.
Yeah.
Because we'd beach it and fight from the ship, I guess. But I listened to his whole talk to us. And, of course, I was just a peon. I didn't get to meet him or anything. But it was an experience.
But that prospect stuck with you.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, here you are on the ship as a musician, and then when the battle's raging, you're helping out the medical staff.
Right.
You'd had no designs of charging ashore and taking on the Germans in hand-to-hand combat.
No way.
So, June 6th, the Texas got into action pretty early that day, huh?
Yes. I remember we traveled all night that night to the coast of France, off the coast of France, Normandy. You can't believe the armada of ships that was out there. You could almost feel like you could step from one ship to another. There's so many ships out there. Of course, you couldn't, but it was quite an experience to wake up. It was still dark, and I could hear airplanes above. They were already bombing, and it wasn't long before we were firing our cannons, making a beachhead for our soldiers to land.
Yeah, you guys were right off of a real famous spot at Omaha Beach, the Point du Hoc, where the Rangers famously scaled those cliffs. But you guys were shelling that position atop those cliffs.
That's right.
And where were you while all this is going on?
I'm on the ship, and we're out just off the coast of Normandy.
Did you have a specific duty station? Were you standing to tend to wounded?
Oh, yes.
Where was your duty station?
With the medical department, and if we got a call, we'd answer that call.
Mm-hmm. Had you ever heard anything like what you were hearing in that moment?
Never.
With all those guns firing?
Never, never.
And I know you're a musician, so you have a finely tuned ear. Can you help us understand what that sounded like?
It's hard to explain, but it was so noisy because there's other big ships firing just like we were, and cruisers and aircraft carriers. In a way, it was kind of exciting because I couldn't see that we were getting any response from the shore at all. Except buzz bombs. We could hear those buzz bombs. And I don't know if you've ever heard of buzz bombs or not, but they didn't have anything that was radio controlled or anything. But they had these bombs that had a motor on them that would carry them out so far and then they'd drop.
Mm-hmm.
And England was experiencing, they almost destroyed London, I guess, with these from across the channel.
Right.
And we could hear them and we could hear some explosions, but none came close to our ship. And we came through unscathed. We didn't even get bombed by airplanes, really, because our airplanes were protecting us above us, as well as bombing the beachhead.
As I understand it, the firing started a little before 6 a.m.
Yeah.
You guys are pounding this beach. And hours later, around noontime, there's this growing concern that, hey, there's more Germans over there than we thought. And the Texas actually went closer to shore to fire the guns.
Well, we were called up to the beachhead had been established. The troops were in, and there was no need for us to be there with our big guns because we couldn't fire. They were so far in, we couldn't fire over them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But they had the Germans trapped out on a peninsula called Cherbourg.
Right.
So they sent a few ships, of which ours was one, were sent up to 10, 12 miles off the coast of Cherbourg, and we started firing on their situation there. We had two planes on our ship that we catapulted off. They were sightseeing planes. They weren't armed or anything. And the spotter planes is what we used them for. We sent them up, and they kind of looked at what the situation was, and they thought that it was secured. We've been bombarding for quite a while. So they sent us in pretty close. We went in within, I don't know the exact distance, but I would imagine within 6 or 8 miles of shore. And then all of a sudden, the Germans all came to life. I was sitting on the deck at the time. I went up on top. All of a sudden, we heard these splashes in the water, and we knew we were being shelled. So we got to our battle station. They sounded battle stations call. We all went to our battle stations.
And we're going to leave you right there for the moment. 91-year-old Leon Christensen of Clovis, California is our guest today. He served on the battleship USS Texas during World War II. That violin he mentioned, here's a little taste of it as we head to break. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.